a note from yesterday. I think the word I was looking for at one point was sankhara. That means often translated as activity or volitional activity. But when Dogen talks about avoiding presumption and choice, for the choice side of things, think willful action. And don't be willful. The distinction between willful and being willing is a huge distinction, but it doesn't actually really loom huge for people early on in their training. But it's a fundamental distinction. There's a number of points here that are covered in the rest of this that I'm going to emphasize. And I'm not going to try to read the whole thing. In the seventh section of Gyakudo Jinshu, Dogen again begins by first of all, talking about the transmission, and then saying, in some countries east of China, meaning some countries east of China. How many countries are there east of China, by the way? Not too many. I guess we're east of China, aren't we? But, Japan and Korea, basically, I think. In some countries east of China, a web of learning rather than true Buddhism has been spread across the seas and mountains. Although it spreads over the mountains, the heart of the cloud is not within it. Although it spreads across the seas, the hearts of the waves are destroyed thereby. Fools take pleasure herein. Such people are as those who would treasure a fisheye in the belief that it was a pearl. There are many who are ruined by falling into the hall of the demons. We don't normally think of scholars in the hall of the demons. But I just want to point out, this thing about erudition, there's more to it than it looks like. He's really talking about an essential point that is emphasized throughout the history of Zen, and that is that you must not allow the head to take the place of the heart. The heart, I mean the heart with a capital H, the Buddha nature, the Buddha mind, the Buddha heart. So, an extreme form of this, again, is where people just get caught in erudition and spin their wheels thinking about Buddhism and developing lots of intellectual theories and never really putting the teachings into practice fully. That shouldn't be taken to mean, by the way, that there isn't such a thing as well-grounded and very, very helpful scholarship, because there is. River Master was quite good at scholarship when she did it, and certainly we've had a number of our monks who are terrific at it and who aren't any less contemplative monks because of that. Like, it's like any other skill, any other form of work. It can be done in the service of the heart, and it can be done as an alternative to serving the heart, following the heart. Really, the essential point is we have to be always careful about not getting caught in our heads, but turning back to meditation. And again, not thinking that that enlightenment has anything to do with, and training has anything to do with intellectual understanding, because it doesn't. I've often said over the years, the brain is the last part of the body to get it. You can't wait for the brain to get it. You have to act on faith, act direct from Buddha nature. Proceed direct from Buddha nature, or you'll be waiting forever. Or Massey used to say, the brain is a computer. It gives you a readout of options. It's not equipped to decide which option is a wise option. You have to choose from something deeper. As with every other part of the body and mind, when the brain is functioning properly in the service of the heart, then it does a very good job. This is not anti-intellectual. It's simply, whether you're intellectual or not is beside the point. I happen to be someone who is pretty intellectually inclined as a young person. And that's, good and well. It doesn't get me anything in terms of training. Nothing whatsoever. And after a while, I realized that my efforts to understand intellectually were just getting me nowhere. But it's decades after that realization, and it's decades after I did my first real letting go of the intellect. But every day I have to watch it that I don't let the head co-opt the heart. See? So there's more to this erudition business than meets the eye. Then he had some rather scathing things to say about Japan. We'll leave that. He had his reasons, I'm sure. Trying to impress on his disciples, probably, that they had to drop some of the ways they'd initially learned and proceed on pure meditation. That can be very difficult to convince someone of that when they've really embarked down that road of trying to make the intellect do the work of the heart and trying to figure it out. In the eighth section of Gyakudo Gyojinshu, he starts again by talking about the transmission. Says, in all the 28 generations in India and the 6 in China, no thread has been added to or a speck of dust taken away from it, the transmission. You remember the other day I was saying, don't make some kind of cultural conglomerate with the teaching. It doesn't need it, and it'll only water it down and muddy it. It needs nothing added to it. This is not something that's cultural dependent. Obviously, it has to adapt. The practice, elements of the practice have to adapt to each culture. The teaching doesn't. The teaching is just the truth as a truth. The level of truth at which we have to train and live and develop a true understanding is universal. It's not cultural. And it's certainly not psychological, sociological, management, business management theory. It's none of this rubbish. When I ask you to leave these things behind, it's not philosophical. It's not scientific. What is passed on from master and disciple is something of the heart. And the teaching that is the kind of verbal and conceptual expression of that is complete in itself and lacks for nothing. People who are always trying to improve on something that already works fine are just wasting their time. Don't try to improve on it. Just try to realize the truth for yourself. If you in ancient footsteps wish to walk, observe examples old. Don't go just with the current fad in cultural thinking. There's an endless parade of such fads. And a truly religious person has to see it as the emptiness that it is. Now here he says something, there's another one of these points I wanted to emphasize. Truth can never be sought. And they who once see the way forget all knowledge and fame, for they transcend relative consciousness. Doesn't it seem a strange thing to say truth can never be sought? Well, then what was I doing if I wasn't seeking the truth? Well, I was being drawn by the truth. I read or interpret my being drawn by the truth as my seeking the truth. But as with just about everything, from the perspective, the worldly perspective, and the true religious perspective, things just get reversed. River Master used to say, before we ever longed for the eternal longed for us. Before we ever longed for external things, before we ever longed for human love and material security, the eternal longed for us. Once you have found the teacher, the teaching, and the practice, the way of training that is the right one for you, then there's nothing more to seek. To go on seeking then is to live in a state of discontent, a willfully perpetuated state of discontent. Instead of seeking, one then has to just actualize what one has been given. You know, put it into practice. When he says, a trainee asked Joshu if a dog had Buddha nature, to which Joshu replied, Mu, probably the most famous of all the kind of formal koans in the Rinzai system. I think it might be the very first one in the system. Maybe that's why it's most famous. A lot of people don't get beyond the first one. Anyway. The great majority of human beings don't need a formal system. Mu means it can be interpreted as no, or nothingness, or emptiness, or it could be interpreted as immaculacy, or it could be interpreted simply as belt up and drop the questions. Drop the questions and be still. He said, Dogen says, how can Mu be measured? There's nothing to hold on to. One must just let go. What are body and mind? What is Zen behavior? What are birth and death? The affairs of the world, mountains, rivers, earth, men, animals, home. If you continue thus, in other words, if you just let it, let go, don't hang on to any aspect, just let go and trust. He says, if you continue thus, neither action nor non-action arises distinct of themselves, and so there is no inflexibility. Few indeed understand this, most suffering from delusion. Action and non-action mean activity and stillness. So he's saying, if you can just live in this letting go, moment to moment, hour to hour, day to day, just keep letting go, just live in that place, which is just a place of meditation, allowing the thoughts to come, allowing them to go, allowing the feelings to come, allowing them to go, allowing the what we perceive, you know, the sounds, the sights to come, allowing them to go. Allowing that which we love to come and allowing it to go. This is the thing. You always get these kind of externalized discussion of these things, and what's really talking about is what we love, what we long for. That's what it's really talking about. You know, who cares about most sights and sounds and the like? They're easy to let go of. What's not so easy to let go is what we're hanging on to dear life. What we're hanging on to for dear life. But everything that is given also is taken away. And a wise person eventually gets to the point where they realize that in the giving there is, they realize in the receiving of the gift that the gift is going to be taken, that it's transitory. And the more we're aware of this, and this is just a basic aspect of awareness, the more we're aware of this, the less we desperately grab onto what is going to be vanishing anyway at some point. So that all you're left with is to fall back on pure meditation. The eternal does not come and go. But you can't hang on to the eternal like you try to hang on to other things. As soon as you grasp after it, you get a handful of nothing. Whereas if you just live in oneness with the flow of immaculacy, with the Uji, the flow of being in time, just live in oneness with it, then there it is. It's always there. It's not going anywhere. There's nothing to hold on to. One must just let go. So here now I'll tell one of my little stories on myself. I'll leave part of a story. I might tell the whole story because there's some things that are just too personal. But you know, and I'm telling this because I just want to show something about why it's so hard to let go. And you know, some of the things we hang on to are actually acutely painful. You think, well, why would I hang on to something so painful? I have a particular memory that whenever it has arisen for decades, and it had something that happened when I was just a kid, but whenever it's arisen for decades, it's just an acute pain with it, goes with it. And recently I had it, and along with a number of other memories from my youth, I had come up. Again, and you're always wondering, what the heck I do with this? It was a not the most earth-shaking event in my life, but it was a point where for a short time I went down a particular course of action out of desperation. And in the course of this, I broke a number of precepts. And the one that was the most important of the precepts I broke was about not telling the truth, the precepts about lying. So what I found out recently is that the reason why this has continued to be so painful for me for all these years is because I couldn't actually accept the fact that I had lied. Even though I knew I'd lied, I couldn't accept the fact. And there's a difference. And so when this memory would come up, I'd focus on something someone else did, or that I would sometimes even construe as what someone else did to me, when really the cause of the continuation of the pain was that I wouldn't actually just accept that I had lied. And that I had, in a situation which I shouldn't have been in the first place, ideally, I'd made it much more painful for me. And I made that pain stick a lot longer because I'd lied. So there's something that I was actually hanging on to in a certain way because I couldn't actually accept the responsibility for my own action. And even though the hanging on caused me pain, I couldn't see what I was doing to myself. Well, why would I not just admit to myself that I'd lied? Because then I'd judge myself, see. So I was trying to prevent myself from judging myself when all I really need to do is actually just not judge myself, you see. But these are the things that are easy to talk about and they're hard to do until they happen. In the end, in this last round of this memory coming up, I really just put it in the hands of the Eternal and asked for help. And then it's just a quiet insight came. Well, this is hanging around the way it is because you won't actually just accept and admit to yourself fully, do Sangha, that you lied and really resolve you don't want to do that again. Mind you, you know, this was like 40 years ago. It's not real recent. But it doesn't matter whether it's recent or not. So this is one of the things about letting go. That behind the difficulty of letting go, there's always self-judgment. The judgment of ourselves is the real killer diller in this business. And we do it without even knowing we're doing it. While we need meditation, we need to bring these little confused jangles. And sometimes the most difficult ones are the seemingly little ones, not the big ones. We need to bring these confused jangles into the heart and meditate with them. And when we realize that, we have no other option than we actually ask for help. You think, well, you could try asking for help sooner, but my experience is that generally we don't even realize we need to ask for help until we actually are able to realize we need to ask for help. This is why this is a harder training than crushing the bones. This little story also points out the importance of Sangha in the process. You know, Sangha is, you know, accepting responsibility for our actions, and it's less than that and more than that all at the same time. In a culture that is so riddled with guilt is our culture, you know, it's kind of hard to imagine what it is to actually really do Sangha. taking for responsibility. You hear people talk about taking responsibility for things, and so often it's got this heavy edge of guilt and self-blame in it. But that's not what the Sangha is. Sangha is just, oh, I did that. I did, yes, I did that. Oh, there's a precept there. Yes, I broke that precept. Boy, I don't want to do that again. It's just that amazing capacity just to see clearly what has happened. That, and just accept it, releases the kind of hold of the past on us. That's why Dogen says, in Shishogi, he says, you know, that Sangha, genuine contrition, brings freedom and immaculacy. So there's a lot more in the letting go than just kind of, you know, and people so often speak and think of these things in the most kind of externalized ways. But letting go is not just throwing something away. In the ninth section of the Gyakuryo Yujinshu, Dogen starts by talking about the transmission again. This isn't an accident. You know, it's not an accident that he speaks so often of transmission. Transmission from heart to heart is a reality beyond what it seems to be. This is something that it took me many years to realize. But when I did realize it, at one of the Jodos, I went up to her master and I said, that what it seemed to me now was that my section of the pipe was screwed onto her section of the pipe, so that it was just one pipe now. That's what was kind of coming up for me intuitively around that time. That there was just my section of the pipe was just screwed onto her section of the pipe, and there's this flow through the pipe. And this flow, what is flowing through the pipe is the transmission. And man did not create this. And master does not give it to disciple. The disciple does not receive it to master. And one person does not give it to another person. It uses us and helps us be a success in our own way. We do not create it. You know, in the history of Buddhism, there's all been all kinds of little glitches, because we live in the human world where we get things confused. There's been all kinds of little glitches relating to the transmission. But the fact that there are glitches at times, or little knots of confusion surrounding the transmission, should never make you doubt that the transmission is real. The transmission, capital T transmission, is, it is. And it's every disciple's duty to so bring their life into harmony with the eternal that the transmission manifests naturally through them as through a vessel. They become a living vessel of the transmission. It doesn't mean one becomes a perfect human being. Doesn't mean that one becomes any more than just an ordinary human being. It means one has given one's life to and is giving one's life to that which is greater than oneself. He goes on to say, to face the way squarely is to know the true source of Buddhism. And this is funny because the master doesn't capitalize true source here. And if she was still alive, I'd make a note to let her know that I think it should be true source, should be T and S should be capitalized here. To face the way squarely is to know the true source of Buddhism and to make clear the approach thereto, for it is beneath the feet of every living person. You find Buddhism in the very spot where you perceive the way. The perfection of self comes with the penetration of enlightenment, but should you become proud of your enlightenment, you will only know the half thereof. What is meant by the perfection of self there is not any worldly idea of perfection. It just means that rather than being destroyed by enlightenment, what we think of as self is dissolves into oneness with the eternal. And those jangles and those knots of pain and confusion that individually and together underlie the illusion of self. You know, have their need met by the eternal. So that the spiritual conversion can happen. So, and the only perfection of self can actually come through transcendence of self. That's the truth of the matter. The only perfection of self can come through transcendence of self. Just to make a better self is not the point of this business. I harp on that a lot. That so many people get suckered in religion into thinking that it's become that the purpose of religion is to become a good person and to be a good person. And that's a mistake, a side effect for the real reality of religion. And this is not the only place here. Just in the preceding paragraph, he says, it is my sincere hope that you will not take pride in gaining the true way. And here he says, should you become proud of your enlightenment, you only know the half thereof. Beginner's mind. We're always, each day, we're just beginning this. When you can forget about all the weeks, months, and years of past training, and you can forget about whatever is coming, and you can just focus on today and be a new trainee today, then you can be content in walking the path. You know, don't make yourself miserable by always keeping track of the score. There is no scorecard. I'll skip a paragraph here, and he goes on to expand on this point that I just made, and that is implicit in what he was saying there. To truly study the ways that try to penetrate in it, to try to penetrate it, and in order to do this, one must forget even the slightest trace of enlightenment. One who would train in Buddhism must first believe completely therein, and in order to do so, one must have true faith. There's not an ism here, really. One must manifest hold fast to true faith, that little light of faith within oneself, that little capacity to look up no matter what's going on, and to hold to the eternal no matter what's going on. That's faith. So in order to do this, one must believe that one has already found the way, never having been lost, deluded, upside down, increasing, decreasing, or mistaken in the first place. One must just train oneself, thus believing this, in order to make the way clear. This is the ground for Buddhist study. So notice what he first says you have to forget enlightenment. And then he says you have to forget about thinking that you're deluded or lost. If you forget about both enlightenment and about being deluded and lost and confused, what's left? It's just the meditation of this moment, the meditation of this day is what's left. It's just living, doing that which needs to be done. So another way to read this is, don't pat yourself on the back and don't judge yourself. He says, they who believe that they are already within the way are truly rare. But if you can truly believe that the opening and closing of the great way are understood quite naturally, and the root of delusion and enlightenment as seen as it is, if you try to cut the function of conscious discrimination, you will almost see the way. If you try to stop judging, that's what that means. In other words, if you put the effort that was going into the habitual keeping score and comparing and tallying up the virtues and vices and all these other ways in which we kind of perpetuate self-judgment and self-congratulation for that matter, if the energy that goes into that instead is put into meditating, then one will almost see the way. But as he says, they who believe that they are already within the way are truly rare. And that is true. That is true. That is because of that, the deep-rooted nature of the self-judgment. That is the mainspring of karma and rebirth, the judgment of oneself. Rinpoche Master used to put it quite simply, the only thing that stands between us and the eternal is our own opinion of ourselves. A another way to put the same thing in the kind of positive way is to say, you know, that all acceptance is a gateless gate. You know, it is we who decide what we will accept and what we will not. And what we will not accept is what will cause us suffering. And our thoughts, our words, and our actions will flow out in such a way that everywhere where we refuse to accept suffering will just flower out of that. And the suffering will be showing us if we know how to look at it or willing to look at it. It's not accepting something here. You're refusing to accept something here. Like in my little story about myself, all those years, 40 years, even though I knew I'd lied, refusing to accept that I'd lied. See? Always finding a way around it. By focusing on some other, it was a complex situation, so focus on another aspect of it, rather than on the fact that I was lying and I was actually not being true to something in myself which was producing the lying. You see? I'm not sitting here blaming myself about this. I'm just using it as an illustration because it's safer for me to use an illustration from my own experience than from someone else's. I'm say, why do you say that about you see? But it is a good example. It's a classic little example. How this works. How we perpetuate suffering. You know, there's another thing that he says here that I want to mention, as long as I'm trying to cover all this, some certain number of bases here. He says, some people greatly desire to perform miracles. These are gravely mistaken, for they are those who forsake their parents and escape or give up treasure and just wander. They are as the only son of a rich father who becomes a beggar through seeking for external things. This is indeed a true picture. I want to say something about the performing miracles thing too. It's so easy. We let ourselves off the hook on these things because, it never occurred to me to want to perform miracles. We don't realize that people don't, you know, start out wanting to perform miracles. They start out wanting. It starts out from wanting to. Wanting to possess some aspect of enlightenment. Wanting to possess enlightenment. And inevitably, since the self doesn't really know what enlightenment is, one ends up picking, you know, taking one's best shot at, you know, what enlightenment might be. And there's been a lot of people in the history of religion who've decided that becoming in some way a special kind of person is what enlightenment is. Being especially virtuous, especially insightful, especially knowledgeable, especially powerful in some way. And there's nothing special about enlightenment. You know, to live by Zen is to live an ordinary daily life. It's, you know, people who have not even meditated, some of them can remember past lives. Some of them can read other people's thoughts to some degree or other. Some of them can do some of the other so-called supernatural powers. Most people, when they've done a lot of training, have some of these things manifest. They're called the six supernatural powers when they're under the influence of delusion. They're called the six wisdoms when it's just happening naturally and spontaneously as a result of the Eternals doing the work within your heart. And sometimes it's good to remember a past life. Sometimes it's good to know what, to have some insight into what someone else might be contemplating. But it is never the purpose of our training to go out and try to do these things. And it is certainly never, never the point of our training and never a manifestation of enlightenment to make a show of such abilities. People can get in a lot of trouble with this stuff. In our training, mostly it's people who, mostly this people, when people get in trouble with the, what are called the six supernatural powers, it's in the area of past life memory. And it's possible to really get confused in that area. It's not something I just know from observation. I've been confused in that area a number of times myself.